Hello and welcome back to Leader Up, a podcast of Army Management Staff College. Leader Up is a professional conversation where we discuss a broad range of leadership topics with an emphasis on the Army civilian professional. I'm your host, David Howie. And on today's episode of Leader Up Audience, we are going to take a look back at the previous year. We're recording this in December of 2024, and we're going to take a look back at some of our highlights from the episodes that we've had through this past year. And before we get into that, I want to thank everybody out there that listens to, participates in, and gives feedback about our podcast. We serve you, the Army civilian. We're here to provide you with information that's helpful to you. And it's really helpful to us when we get your feedback and we get feedback that we're talking about things that you're interested in. And when you ask us to talk about certain topics, that we're able to do that. It's very, very rewarding to be able to do that. And one other thing I want to talk about at the end of this year, before we start with our clips from the year, is I want to thank our previous producer, Mr. Chad Cardwell, who has moved on to the advanced course here in AMSC. He's still here, but he's not really associated with Leader Up. I really thank Chad for all of the work that he did in getting this podcast set up. And of course, we have a new producer, dear friend of mine, Mr. Steve Saffel, who is a facilitator also down in the department where I work. I just want to thank Chad for what he did for Leader Up, and I want to welcome and thank also Steve. He's made some really, really good improvements to this podcast so that we can continue to provide you, our audience, with a very, very useful product. And so I want to go to our very first clip that we would like to highlight for you, and this is a clip that our director, Mr. Frank Wenzel, did just a couple of months ago. It hasn't been that long, but he talked about three very important policy changes that affect the CES program. So let's listen now to Mr. Frank Wenzel as he talks about those policy changes that will affect the civilian education system.
The Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower Reserve Affairs, Dr. Schaefer, recently signed the three new policies, August 12th, I believe it was, and these have been quite well received by the field, partly because of a lot of hard work that's been done listening to the field and socializing these as we saw them as emerging requirements a year ago for the betterment of the development of our civilian cohort. The first one being eliminating the equivalent constructive credit option for the civilian education. For those who don't know, a decision was made years ago in the mid to late 80s, looked at the number of students who would have to attend their grade requisite course. The numbers were just too big, and realized we will never get what was tagged a backlog through. So the solution was made, well, okay, those newly hired civilian supervisors who were graduates of these PME courses, we'll just give them credit. For instance, Command General Staff College, the Warrant Officer Career College, the Sergeant Major Academy. And as many decisions are done for fiscal reasons, it was accepted and got us through some many early years of the wickets. But as time went on, we started to realize collectively that maybe we're not doing the best for our cohort and for the Army at large by granting that credit. So we took, number one, a look at the outcomes of those courses that we were granting equivalent credit for. They do not match, and good that they don't. So that automatically feeds, well, then why are we giving credit? You know, someone like me who gets credit for his experience when we just established is not the same. So the response to the change in that policy has been, I've been impressed, extremely positive, because basically, you know, it's tough. We're saying, hey, newly graduated Lieutenant Colonel, Seat of U5 Sergeant Major, 3 years ago, you didn't have to come to CES, but now you are. I was interested to see how this would play out. It has been a win. Those professionals who come in as new members of our cohort bring with them the wealth of, in most cases, two decades of experience what they are bringing into our seminar environment is irreplaceable. It is positive. It is valued by their classmates. What I also see based on feedback from those same individuals, by the time their experience is done in CES, they're leaving here, well, what do you know? I'm now an Army civilian professional. I understand this isn't the same. And I have a unique new set of skill sets that I can bring to my senior organization. So that one has been just a plus. And it's basically that one's enacted. It's done. There just is no more equivalent credit. And we've had a couple months of seeing this play out, and it's been great. The second one, auto enrollment, essentially when a supervisor is named a supervisor for the first time, they are going to be automatically enrolled in their grade requisite CES course for 3 years down the road. So if you've got a, you know, GS-12 brand new supervisor, they're going to come to the resident course here at Fort Leavenworth in 3 years. Now, the idea being, they know that's out there. They're going to come here, but they have time with their supervisor to work out, you know, I think in our workload, it makes more sense that I go in 2 years. I'm not ready now. I need a little bit of experience under the belt. So I have a little bit of, you know, proper point of reference and skill set to take what they're going to impart me in CES. So I'd like to go in 2 years. They can schedule it out. It goes in their IDP. They enroll in CES in whatever modality fits their timeline. So the fact that they were going to come here in 3 years, that they're already done before it gets here. That one's getting well received by the field, and we'll see. It'll take a couple of years till we see the bow wave of that coming in. Now, those who want to change it, I'd recommend those plan it out very well, because the backstop is if someone wants to change their auto enrolled resident course attendance, which they're going to be put in 3 years down the road, it's going to require the first GO or SES in their chain of command to get on board with that change. So it's not something to be taken lightly if someone can't meet their requirement to be here. But the best thing is to work with your supervisor and front load that thing on your personal timeline. More details on the Chartist website for either one of those, and I urge you to burrow in there and see. You know, for instance, special cases. Okay, well, I'm in my probationary period. That's how you define a new supervisor. We're using those in their probationary period. Someone who's in their probationary period for 1 year right now with this new policy, how does it work for me? I urge you to burrow into Chartist. Individual cases of what could be timing when are myriad, but we'll do the right thing by everybody. The final one is quota management. And I don't want to bash the way we've done things, because all the decisions made for how we got here were well-intentioned by folks who were doing the absolute best for the Army at that point of time. So I don't, it's easy to sit here now and look back and say, well, whoever those now retired individuals were decided that, that's not what we're dealing with. Quotas made sense at a certain point before the automation was as advanced and prevalent as it was now to guard certain numbers of seats for certain commands. So for instance, ForceCom would have 10 seats to use for an intermediate course in February. If they wanted to put in 13 students, we can guarantee 10 because that's their quota. The other three would have to go on a wait list and they wouldn't be guaranteed a seat until 45 days out. In the meantime, another command, for reasons that make perfect sense, they couldn't fill their quotas. Maybe they had a massive exercise going on at Paycom at the time, and no one can go during the February course, but those seats were still blocked for those commands, even though they were not going to use them. Under the new quota management system, it's first come, first serve. If there are seats available for a February course, for the intermediate course, and your supervisor agrees, you can sign up right now and you're going to get that seat, regardless of the fill in your commands. We're easing this in between now and a year from now, 1 October of 2025, just so we don't radically change the system out of control. Quota managers are used to the old way of doing things. We're still easing into it, even though all the quotas now are centrally owned. We're still working with individual commands and allowing them to fill up the seats that they were expecting through the FY. It's just the timing of when the policy was signed. We didn't want to radically change it too fast. All three of these policies, we see very positive impact coming. Number one, to make sure we don't have empty seats, even though we have students who want to get in. That's the quotas. Number two is just automatically enrolling new supervisors into the course. So it is going to happen. They're going to come. And that is an Army requirement that supervisors have to take their grade requisite CES.
It's in 350-1.
Exactly right. So that's not new. This is just a way of saying, hey, well, we're just set up some timelines. And finally, elimination of the equivalent constructive credit, which again has been very well received with what I've heard from the field and what I've seen in the seminars. All very positive.
And so you can kind of hear in that clip that Frank Wentzel was talking about how the CES program and Army Management Staff College is going to become more and more prevalent in the lives of Army civilians. And that auto-enroll piece for supervisors, that's kind of an indicator that we, the Army, is going to really get serious about having supervisors of civilians who have the requisite training and education to be effective. I want to switch now over to my commanding general, Lieutenant General Milford Beagle, who is the CAC commander. I had a great conversation with him. I talked to him for over an hour about leadership and leader development. It was really a great, great conversation. One of the things that I always like to ask, especially the military senior leaders, and that's general officers and command sergeants major, is how they see the role of Army civilians, how that role has changed or evolved over the years. So let's listen in and see what General Beagle had to say about that.
Yeah, and this may sound a little bit bad, but I think it's something that we always say. And typically, you know, coming up, you because you hear the stories, you hear some of the myth and the legend about civilians. And so there's this stereotype of the little old man in tennis shoes or the little old lady in tennis shoes. It's just kind of what you think because of at the level you're at, generally that's who you're interacting with, whether it be CIF or, you know, customer service in some part of the organization or on the installation. Then that's kind of the thing that most will grow up with until you get a little bit older. And I had the great fortune of interacting with our Army civilian professional much earlier in my career, from captain all the way up to this point. And you can see what our civilian professionals bring to the table because you're not seeing that common, you know, perpetuated myth, urban legend, your civilians, here's what they do. They're going to be, you know, a barrier for you. That's really not the case. You really have to understand what they do for our entire organization. And I've been able to see that. And as you mentioned, my last, you know, decade for me has been back and forth between operating force and institutional force, ForceCom and TRADOC. So you've seen it from that. So I've seen it from that perspective as well, which is also very unique. When you're on the institutional side, there's a much heavier quantity of Army civilian professionals in TRADOC. That's just how we're generally designed across the board. In ForceCom, not as high, but the importance and the relevance is, I would say, even higher when you talk about things like continuity, stability, et cetera. It's just a different dynamic, but the importance nonetheless is there. We were at the Army Profession Forum, and he's pulled me to the side and he said, why don't we use arms? It should be profession of arms. And I'm literally pinned in a corner with a 4-star. I'm like, sir, I got you. I hear you. And I'm listening. And typically that's how you hear it stated, the Army profession or profession of arms. But when you think about it, fundamentally, you know, in our own doctrine, our profession is two things. It's the profession of arms is our green suiters, all compos. And the other side of our profession is our Army civilian professionals. So the two together is the profession. You split it apart, profession of arm, green suiters, and our Army civilian professionals. That makes up our profession. And that's in our doctrine and in our logic maps. And so you have to have the two for our entire Army. That is our profession. Yeah. And I think, I don't know the exact number, but I think, you know, we would look at data and see that a higher percentage of our Army civilian professionals have had some experience in the military. They've served at some point. So they bring to the table that leadership experience. It's not like they forgot, regardless of where they were, regardless of how long they served or what position they served in, but they're bringing that component of leadership that they've learned throughout their time in the Army. So they bring that dynamic in. And even those that have not, I think they bring experience and that ability to lead into our formation. And when you think of the stability component of it, our civilian professionals that have been in an organization for any amount of time have now seen what an organization has gone through. You're going to see, you know, multiple turnovers. You're going to see different things change over time, priorities, focus, et cetera. So that stability, in my mind, is a matter of seeing that organization evolve over time. And then the continuity piece is preventing that organization from stepping into or stepping over, you know, pitfalls over time. There's your continuity piece, because now they can see a little bit further ahead because of the stability component. They kind of know what this organization has been through, changes, shifts. That continuity comes in is based on, at least to me, what you can see now going forward. We can avoid some of these pitfalls because you've seen the history, the dynamic of the leadership that you bring to the table. You can help keep that team steady. You can help that team see themselves, and those that are coming in new, help them integrate into the team. So I do agree fundamentally with those three components of the definition, and I've described those, you know, in my own way, but those, the components are key.
And so what you heard from General Beagle there was those three things: leadership, stability, and continuity. And those actually are in ADP 622 in the Civilian Corps Creed. So those are the things that we're supposed to be doing. And he talked very eloquently there about why they're important and how we might see those in the Army Civilian Corps. One of my other guests that I really, really enjoyed this conversation was with Major General David Doyle, who is the commander of Fort Carson and the 4th Infantry Division. His viewpoint of pulling civilians into discussions and really pulling out from civilians the way things have happened historically, how that is so important. And he talked about some ways that he does that and some ways that he has made that effective. I want to first talk about the role of Army civilians and just thinking back on your career, how you've seen the role of Army civilians change during that time frame.
Well, the importance of the Army civilian has never changed. In fact, what I would submit is, as we've become a little bit more of a lean force and we've dealt with resource scarcity in our uniform military, the continuity and the consistency of our Army civilians becomes even more crucial. Over 30 years, you know, the Army's force structure has changed, gone up, gone down. And what I've witnessed is when we have the right Army civilians in the right positions, we're able to manage systems properly, we're managing resources properly. And then what we also do is ensure that the organization is focused. Sometimes the individual commanders who arrive on the scene want to try different things, and that's great. It's always useful to have creative thought and innovative ideas, but the focus on actual mission accomplishment with experience is often vested in some of our Army civilians who stay through transitions and see the growth and development of organizations. So that's what I've witnessed over 30 years.
And I think you're right that the right balance is when we have that stability and continuity that civilians provide with kind of that, hey, here's some new ideas. Here's the broadening things that I've seen after going around the Army for years and years. And when that relationship is done well, when there's the right mixture, it's extremely powerful.
David, you're exactly right. And that requires some dialogue and engagement. It requires consistent interaction. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit about the methods that we use to keep our workforce informed and allow them to understand that which is a, you know, necessary change versus the things that are probably not worth the squeeze when you go through, you know, the adjustments. I watched a couple of my DA civilians, the folks that I trusted the most, engage with me and say, hey, let me just tell you some history on things that have happened so you can make an informed decision. And because we had a good collaborative engagement plan and it was consistent and iterative, I was able to take some of that experience and I wouldn't say temper, but adjust the modifications I wanted to make to our organization.
An extremely important point is that you're attempting to create a climate where the civilians feel like they can come in and say, hey, let's think about this part of it. And that makes the decision even better when there's that kind of a dialogue.
Oh, you're right. We, you know, in the fielded force have gone through a couple evolutions. And during the period of deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq, we established the mission support element. And our DA civilians were basically the continuity that kept an installation running while the preponderance of the leadership were forward deployed. And that model worked extremely well. And we were able to kind of harvest experience from retired military personnel or personnel who were highly trained professionals that could keep a base from, you know, collapsing on its own mass. We then took away, at least in the ForceCom realm, we took away that mission support element, and we did a full staff integration where the Department of the Army civilians started working with the uniform staff, at least at the division level and somewhat at the installation level. And so that change was pretty substantial because you no longer were worried about having a standalone capability. You were worried about how do I make all of this work together in a cohesive form? And I think that's the model most of our, at least the divisions in ForceCom are using right now. But there's always this thought that we may get called to take an entire installation's worth of leaders and go elsewhere. And it's unlikely, you know, that a garrison team is going to be able to run everything in support of a division or a core headquarters. So we're reconsidering, you know, the different models. And again, going back to those people who were there, who witnessed it, you can learn. You can absolutely appreciate their experience. But it does take dialogue. It does take interaction. It does take formalized sessions for an engagement.
And what you just said probably answers my next question, but I'm going to pose it, and maybe you have other ideas, but it's about the importance of Army civilians completing their professional education. So that's what we do at Army Management Staff College. We do the different courses that are about leadership at the different levels for Army civilians. So why is that important? And given all of the things that you just talked about, alignment, communication, dialogue, why is it important in that light for Army civilians to complete their professional education?
Well, the way that the civilian professional education program is designed is not only does it equip them for management requirements and additional responsibility, it brings them into a more current understanding of what the Army is doing. And sometimes when you get into a mode where you've been very familiar with your problem set, your set of requirements, your role, you don't have the opportunity to see the broader picture. And I think that's what the education program is really good at right now, is opening up the Army level issues or Army level topics of discussion and introducing that into the curriculum. And then your Department of the Army civilians can see where they fit in the system, but also see what the Army's working towards. What is the manner in which the Army's trying to evolve? And then they can make great judgments on how to help that out.
And so if I'm a civilian toiling away at a depot somewhere, and I come here to Army Management Staff College and go through the advanced course, and I hear from senior leaders intent kind of statements, this is what we're trying to accomplish, then it helps me when I go back and I'm in my cubicle doing a job to see how what I'm doing fits into the big picture.
It does. It gives a little bit more sense of purpose. My estimation is you understand how you're connected. It understands what the priorities are, those things that matter the most versus those things that are maybe less important for, you know, urgent accomplishment. And then lastly, it lets people see that they're part of a big team. And I think the Rolodex building that you get at a professional military education course is almost as valuable as the education experience itself. You sit with and talk to or engage virtually with those members of other organizations, and you start identifying those people who can help you, help your organization, or just be, you know, reliable sounding boards. So in any professional military education opportunity, you have that the chance to become more connected to the rest of the force.
I really thought what General Doyle said there was really, really illuminating and very helpful. And I really like just his attitude about bringing civilians into the process and really seeking out what they have to say about things. The next clip I want to play for you is Mr. Paul Landauer. And Paul Landauer is the J-8 at AFRICOM. And this was also a very interesting conversation, and he took it in kind of a different direction. He did talk about the stability and continuity. He also talked about the evolving or the changing nature of Army civilians and the need for us to have a high level of depth and breadth And when we have that depth and breadth, it helps us provide good recommendations back to our chain of command. So let's give Mr. Landauer a listen.
And you kind of bring me to my next point that I want to talk about, and it is the changing or evolving role of civilians in the workplace. How have you seen the role of those folks change since the time that you've been associated with the military?
I'll bring to light some things that have changed and some things that haven't. Civilians are the continuity, and that really hasn't changed. What I think has changed is that the civilian teammates are taking on a more prominent role because of the way information is flowing and because of that continuity, and truly because the time it takes to drive what is major change or major transformation, is that I've seen civilians take a more prominent role at the boardroom table, right? At those key leader decision points. And that's a combination of, you know, data is moving at the speed of operations or speed of relevance. And therefore, having folks that have enough depth and breadth to really bring in that level of information is important because there's that continuity aspect. But also is that major change, and I think all of DoD certainly is you know, we're in a constant state of change for sure. But the DoD landscape is shifting around us in pretty rapid succession. And our civilian teammates present a unique position to bring different insights, some built on continuity and some built on varied experience that allows us to offer a perspective that we might not otherwise get. And so it's really things are the same, but things are dramatically different, if you will. And I've seen where the civilian teammates are in a much more prominent role than they've been in the past, and being asked to provide, a much more significant, advice and insight. And that isn't to downplay what our military members are providing. Our warfighters are critical, and their experience and their role. But as the DoD evolves, I think the civilian contribution continues to be significant and grow over time to complement our warfighters, if you will.
And in our leadership manual, ADP 622, when we published the most recent version of it a couple of years back, the Civilian Corps Creed was updated to say, instead of just saying we provide or I provide stability and continuity, that creed was updated to say I provide leadership, stability, and continuity. And I think that's what you're kind of getting at, is we look at civilians and we say you need to roll your sleeves up, get involved. Get involved early so that you can affect things before they happen, not being brought in, like you're saying, after the fact, or to stand on the sidelines and just be the Monday morning quarterback, which is kind of the way civilians were looked at, I'll say 30 or so years ago. And I think you're right that we expect more from civilians, and civilians are being expect more is expected of them, and we are giving them the tools to perform those functions in the organizations.
Yeah, one of the things that I got illumined to and highlighted was as you do coaching and mentoring, a lot of folks will be like, well, I need to be in this role to be a leader. I need to be the branch head. I need to be the div chief. What I always encourage people is to choose to lead wherever you are. And there's great books out there, 360 degree leadership. There's a couple others. But don't wait to be in a role to provide leadership. Be a leader wherever, whatever role you're in. Don't be afraid to take on that leadership role. That's where you cut your teeth. That's where you show and you develop your what kind of leader you're going to be. You develop it as you go through your career. It doesn't like you It's not like you land in some job and suddenly you're a leader. You know, you're honing your craft your whole career. And so if you see it that way, then you're constantly looking for opportunities to provide leadership and share leadership and grow others and mentor. I think that's a, you know, that's been a shift, if you will, as opposed to just being a bunch of doers, is that we're all a bunch of leaders. Are we willing to step into that role in a meaningful way? Because I don't know a supervisor out there, and I don't know a leader out there who doesn't love to see that happen, right? When you challenge somebody and they step into a leadership role, or they choose to step into it of their own accord, you know, that's just the most exciting thing ever, watching somebody come into their own out of their own volition. It's exciting, but I think it's an evolution from civilians just being doers to that we're all leaders in our organization, no matter where we sit.
And so once again, Mr. Landauer was talking about the importance for us as Army civilians to have that level of depth and breadth about what we do so that we can see more than just our job and our cubicle, but we can understand kind of how we fit into the big picture. The next clip that I want to play for you is Ms. Catherine Coviello, who is an intelligence analyst and an intelligence advisor. And she talked about the different roles, and the analogy that she used is fireman versus fire chief, and how they're different roles and they have to be balanced in an organization. And sometimes we're called upon to play different roles. Do we know which role is required from us in a given situation?
I'd like to turn to another concept that I heard you talk about this. And it is this delineation between being the fire chief and the fire man or the fire person. And what's the significance of that delineation?
Yes, that's a great analogy that was posed to me when I was seeking some mentoring from one of my intelligence executive colleagues. And he said to me, he said, Kathy, you have a choice, but do you want to be the fire chief or do you want to be the fireman? And maybe I was a little slow on the uptake, but I had to think about that for a while. And it's an analogy. So is you are technical. You are not in a formal leadership position, leading a division or organization, but you are the technical expert at what you do. Your job is to put up fires, literally, in this case, at a fire department. You get to drive the fire engine. You get to climb the ladder. You get to spray the hose and the foam, you get to chop down the door and rescue the kitten or the baby from the burning structure. And that is really important because the whole department is important. And without firemen, the fire chiefs wouldn't have a need to exist. The fire chief is there to enable, through management and leadership, the resources and the rules, or in some cases we call it policy, to allow the firemen to do their job. The fire chief has to make sure there's money in the budget to pay for the foam. The fire chief has to make sure there is sufficient maintenance to keep the fire engines up and running. The fire chief needs to manage personalities on the team. If William and Walter are not getting along, maybe they're not ride on the same fire truck, right? They have to figure that out and then figure out how we can get them to ride on the same fire truck when necessary. They're both very important roles. One is not lesser than the other. And when I was talking to a group of folks out in Arizona last week, I told them, I said, you have to think about it. Where are your preferences? You know, I asked them by a show of hands, I said, if I could pay you $200,000 a year, and I just threw an easy number up, to do what you do as a technical person or as a supervisor of technical people, how many of you would be a supervisor? And a show of hands went up. And then how many of you would opt for technical? And another show of hands went up. Now, believe it or not, this entire group was made of supervisors. And I told them that's okay. Supervisory duties are challenging in their own way. They have other technical aspects on the HR side, human resources side. They have technical aspects on the performance management side and on the budgetary side. And it's okay. If you don't want that, there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to stay technical, we need you on the team. That's important too. Now, what happens is as people look to advance in their careers, often they'll take the fire chief job because it's a pay raise, not because it's really what they want to do. And they may grow into the role or they might be miserable. So I ask them to think about it, do some self-reflection. If you had a choice between the fireman and the fire chief, what direction would you go? My current role is that of a fireman. Now, I am the technical expert fireman, and I do some of my own leadership from the middle. I'm helping folks see opportunities. I'm helping them discover resources, but I'm not a decision maker. I'm in an advisory role. Again, a valued member of the team, but not in charge.
And if I sign up to be the fire chief, I kind of have to realize that my days of climbing up the ladder and physically putting out fires or rescuing kittens or whatever the case might be, those days may be over for me. And I need to not try to continue to do those things if I have signed up to be a supervisor. Is that correct?
I would say that is, for the most part, correct. You maintain a level of street credibility, if you want to call it street cred, if you can still climb the ladder. They have a video of you climbing the ladder in your younger days. You want to understand, at least at a good working level, the roles of those that are serving in the firemen roles. And oh, by the way, you know, technology and the global environment is changing what the technical folks are doing. So you have to stay current, but you really need to work hard to fight for those resources to enable the firemen and to fight for the policies to give them what they need to do their jobs to their utmost.
I thought that was an interesting point that she made about the roles that we play, the fireman versus the fire chief. Does that happen to you? Do you see that in your organization where the people that are supposed to be providing the leadership part or supposed to be supervising have a tendency to get involved maybe a little bit too much, and people aren't doing what they're supposed to do because they're either worried about what someone else is doing or they're trying to take over? So the next clip that I want to talk to you about is really, really enjoyed this conversation. This was the Honorable Mr. Christopher Lohman, who is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Logistics. And he told me that he considers himself to be the senior logistician in DOD, not just in the Army, but in DOD. He talked also about roles. One of the things that he really talked about a lot was taking on difficult jobs, assuming roles that other people don't want to do, and how that is important, especially for us as Army civilians. When you're wearing the uniform, a lot of those roles will get put on you when you change your duty station and you go get assigned somewhere. But for Army civilians, we have to seek those things out. We have to go to where the hard jobs are. And sometimes it's easy to avoid that if we are not willing to go out and find those hard jobs and be willing to take risks and get out there and get our hands dirty.
I figured over the last 35 years as an Army civilian, I've hit just about every echelon of working relationship, team relationships, and leadership roles that you can imagine. About mid-career wise, I PCS'd my family and I to Europe to be the chief of supply and maintenance for the United States Army in Europe. I then deployed to Afghanistan some years later in an executive role to lead what was then called Essential Function 5, which was the capacity building responsibility for medical logistics, the traditional maintenance, transportation, and supply roles for the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Justice. Also, the building out the network capabilities for the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Interior. Following that, came over to back to the Headquarters Department of the Army, took on a role as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Strategic Planning, the G357, really my first role outside of the logistics community. And then from that role, was asked to serve as the acting Undersecretary of the Army and then assumed, once confirmed by the Senate, assumed the responsibility as the Assistant Secretary of Defense. So what I'll tell you is kind of common theme through all of those roles was really a willingness to cross organizational boundaries, to assume roles where I wasn't necessarily the technical expert going into those roles. And so assuming uncomfortable career broadening type assignments. And finally, really understanding and developing from very early on an understanding of the role of an Army civilian, the relationship with our uniformed service members, and the leadership necessary to push initiatives that are critical to the execution of the Army's mission, and being willing to stand out in front and lead from the front, whether you're leading a team of technical experts or you're leading a team of policy experts, or frankly, whether you're communicating the Army's mission external to the Army, whether it's to the Hill, on Congress, to Congress members or professional staff members, to the press, or to your neighbors at home. I mean, what it takes is a willingness to communicate the Army's mission, to take on responsibilities and follow through, and finally, to uphold the standards of the Army in whatever role you happen to have.
I really enjoyed that discussion that I had with Mr. Lohman. It was really, really interesting, really exciting talking to someone from that level about leadership and leader development. The next clip that I want to play for you is one from a member of our faculty. This is someone that I consider to be a very good friend. This is Mr. Gary Heisel. And we talked about followership, which is a topic that has only recently been talked about to any great extent. How important is followership in your organization? Gary also talks about the different roles that we play in organizations, and one of them is as a follower. And he talks about how the kind of the guiding light for which role or which persona should I put on is about the mission and the purpose of the organization. And he talks in this clip about the four different types of followers. So let's give Gary Heisel a listen. The quote is from Aristotle, and it is, "He who cannot be a good follower cannot be a good leader." Do you agree with that? And how would that help us understand a little bit about this idea of followership?
I think as an Army civilian, and really in the uniform as well, that we are servant leaders. And to be a good servant, you have to follow. But you also have to lead. So you sort of go in and out of these roles. So you have to understand how to follow to be a good leader. And that's really what I think this whole idea of servant leadership is about. You may be in a position of authority, but you're necessarily not leading at that point, because David Howie's got the information. He knows the mission purpose better than the supervisor. So he sort of fills a followership role at that point where you're leading. And then as he takes on the role of leading the organization in a different capacity, you fall into the followership role. And he's the leader at that point. So I think the mission and the purpose really is the thing that drives us in this. And that's sort of the crux of the followership lesson, that we're driven by the mission or the purpose. That's what we gravitate around, both the leader and the follower. We're getting ready to go into Iraq in 2004. I'm the battalion commander, but they're really training me. And I'm following their example of how we do, you know, four-man stacks to go in and take down a building. I'd never done that. I'm an artilleryman. I don't know how to do that. They do. So I had to basically assume a followership role, let them lead, even though they were corporals and staff sergeants. So that's an excellent example that hits home with me for sure.
There are different types of followers. And so can we just talk about the different types and kind of when they are helpful, when they're useful, when it's effective, and maybe times when it's not effective to be that kind of a follower?
This is a new lesson that we're rolling out, followership. And I'm pretty excited about it. Peter O'Gan, who's my co-author of the lesson, we took a book by Ira Shelliff, who talks about the courageous follower, and he breaks it down into these four types that you mentioned. And I'll just kind of walk through each one of those types. So the first type is the resource. And the resource is really somebody who comes to work, does their job, his or her job, accomplishes the mission, but really doesn't take a whole lot of initiative and go beyond what, you know, the mission dictates or your duty description dictates. So they're a resource. Do we need resource folks that want to do that? You betcha. Some people just want to come in and do 8 hours of work or whatever time frame they need to do to fill the mission. So resource is the first type. The second type is the individualist. So the individualist really doesn't have a whole big regard for the leader, sort of a low opinion of the leader, if you will, but is willing to push back on the leader and sometimes questions everything the leader does, but will call them out, especially if they're going in the wrong direction. So individualist, right? The other type is implementer. The implementer is somebody who can get behind the leader, will always implement whatever policy, whatever the mission dictates, won't necessarily question the leader if they're going sort of in left field or doing something that may not be quite right. That's the implementer. And then there's the partner. The partner always gives vigor support to the leader, willing to do what it takes to get the mission done, but will also question when things are not going the right direction or maybe it's illegal or immoral. I think that's what Ira gets to when he talks about the courageous follower, that we just don't, you know, get in line and do whatever the boss or the leader says. But I think all four of these we feel different times. So none of them are better than the other one. Maybe the partner and implementer or what we do or we want to see folks in followership do more than being just an individualist or resource. But there's times when you need to be a resource or call the boss out and be an individual.
Which of the roles that we take on could be dependent on the relationship we have with that leader, the level of trust, and it also could be the topic or what the mission is. Is that, are you on board with that assessment?
Yeah, I think, you know, national defense is the purpose and why we do what we do, is to support our nation, support the American people. So that we're drawn to that mission. Sometimes we're drawn to a charismatic leader or somebody who we just thoroughly believe in. So we're drawn to that. But I think what everything revolves around is the mission or the purpose. But we could fill a different role. Say the boss isn't as enigmatic or, you know, doesn't inspire us to do or motivate us to do things, but the purpose does. So we can still be a partner or we can still be an implementer. Sometimes we just kind of fill a role and fill a resource role. Sometimes we need to be that individualist to call the boss out, but not do that all the time.
I really thought those four different follower types was very interesting. And you might consider in your organization, do you see yourself in one of those four follower types? And is it effective? Are you being the follower based on the mission and the purpose of the organization? Are you being the type of follower that your organization needs? And so, Leader Up audience, that is the end of our 2024 end of year program. And I really want to thank each one of you for being a listener of Leader Up. And I want to thank you for subscribing. And I want to thank you for sending in your comments and giving us the feedback and the questions that we've had about future episodes, because we try to act on those whenever we possibly can. And so let's just think a little bit about some of the things that you heard this year on Leader Up, some of the things that have meaning for you, some of the lessons maybe that you're thinking about now. These are some things that I want to start focusing on in the new year, some things that'll help make me be a better Army civilian. And so we're going to close this episode out with some of our favorite quotes from our guests over the past year, So that's what we're going to end up with. And I'll just want to tell you one more time, thank you. We will see you again in 2025.
True success, it gets to the point, like I said, everybody gets to the point where you'd think it was their idea to begin with.
Keystone of our profession, and it's not delegation, but it's trust.
You're going to spend 70% of your time working on you first to make sure you understand what it is that you want, what it is that you're trying to get out of this conversation. And if your only goal is, oh, I got to win the conversation, then you're looking at this crucial conversation all wrong.
One of the most important responsibilities we have as we move through our career is to give back and build the bench and delegate and take that risk. Let folks learn.
Yeah, it's incredibly rewarding. You know, being influential and modeling is important for all of our leaders. And whether you're at a senior grade or a junior grade, you're somebody's supervisor. And that makes an impression upon people, especially when you do it in a thoughtful and caring way.
Everybody, regardless of where you sit, regardless of your grade, can benefit from a network of advisors, and everybody could benefit from your experience.
As always, if you have any questions or feedback or would like to learn more about our podcast, please check the description for our email and for our website. Thanks for listening.